Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 51, and today I'm in Washington, D.C. at the Advancing Public Philosophy Conference, and I am very pleased to have five guests today. This might be the biggest, one of the biggest digital dialogue podcasts that I've had. So I have Mark Fisher, who is the Assistant Director of the Rock Ethics Institute and who is also the Coordinator of Teaching and Learning with Technology in the Philosophy Department at Penn State. I have Ronald Sundstrom, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of San Francisco. And I have Corey Wong here, who is has been on the Digital Dialogue before and who is a graduate student in the Department of Philosophy and co-facilitator of our workshop yesterday here at the Advancing Public Philosophy Conference. With me also is Jessica Harper, who is a partner at the Boddicker, Ramsey, Andrews, Winograd, and Wildstein law firm here in Washington. I'll try and get all those names correct. And Vance Ricks finally is with us, who's associate professor of philosophy at Guilford College. Actually, I think your law firm is not here in Washington.
As it turns out, it's in Atlanta.
No, it's in Atlanta. See?
But thank you.
I just feel like I'm in Washington. Everybody should be. one of the thing we're here to discuss, we had two really excellent sessions yesterday here at the Advancing Public Philosophy Conference. Mark and Vance coordinated the session on social media ethics, and we had 3 hours of discussion of that, and Ron was in that session. And then in the afternoon, Corey and I facilitated a session on social media and the digital public. And we had another wide-ranging discussion there. So there's a lot of issues that came up yesterday, and I thought it would be a great idea for us to take a little time, and I appreciate everybody taking the time to come on the Digital Dialogue and join me. So maybe we could begin just by talking about some of the themes that came out of the two sessions. I thought there were some real interesting connections between the two. Corey wasn't at the first one, but Jessica was, and so we have a sort of can fill in the gaps there. And so, does anybody have some themes they want to start off with?
Before we do that, I want to also bring Veena Raman into the conversation, who is a colleague who was to have been the third co-facilitator with the workshop that Mark and I led, and wasn't able to be here.
Right. But we did Skype her.
She did join us
right.
by Skype.
That was
for part of the conversation.
Right.
So very, very glad for that.
Good. Yeah, and Veena is a colleague of ours at Penn State. Mm-hmm. She teaches in the Communication Arts and Sciences department and is doing a lot of thinking about social media and communication. So themes. Any thoughts on which themes we should focus on?
Well, the one
the
one thing that came up in the first session and the second session that I think is quite important to think about in this new area of philosophy, it's a very new sub-area, is what scholarship looks like as a social as a social media ethicist or in social media ethics. I personally hope it's more than just taking a new problem, affirmative action, abortion, euthanasia, Facebook, and running it through the machinery that we have. That can be done, careers can be made, interesting insights can be had, but it's not as transformative as the subject of social media is itself transformative, mm-hmm. or as the potential of social media. If all we do is give you yet another way that the categorical imperative applies to questions of, say, publicity on Facebook or on Google+. That's great, but it's also not as explosive as the possibility as the social media is itself.
Yeah, I think one of the things that emerged in both sessions was sort of not only performing philosophy using these social media tools, but also thinking reflectively about what they're doing. What these tools are doing, and I think Ron, you were making a point that was very compelling, and certainly in the beginning, in the first session, about being very aware of the kinds of models for financial models some of these social media networks are operating under. Google and Facebook are using information to sell advertising and those sorts of things, and that, so that colors from the beginning, or at least that's something we need to be aware of from the beginning when we use these different media.
Absolutely. The owl maneuvers owl flying really fast, beating those little wings, trying to figure out what's going on, trying to figure out how does this technology work, not just our interface with it, but how, what are the fundamentals of this technology, how does it work, and what are the what are the financial and corporate structures behind it. Mm-hmm. Not that those are bad things necessarily, but we should know what we're dealing with. As we engage in public philosophy about these technologies, mm-hmm. these platforms.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. As we do a lot in the College of Liberal Arts at Penn State, reflect on the affordances of these technologies and have our minds very much oriented towards how we can use them in service of fairly traditional values of liberal arts. We also want to be sure that these technologies are not just paying lip service to some of the things that we hold valuable, but that they actually are affording what it is that they claim to be affording. So if we're interested in the use of technology because of the different kinds of access that it provides, not only access to resources that we wouldn't otherwise have, but allowing access in to people who wouldn't otherwise have access to these discussions, we want to be sure that we're not sort of naively relying on, of course, the technology is doing this, but we want to make sure that we're reflecting on the extent to which those promises are actually made good, and be wary of the possibility that some of these promises are ad slogans, right? That if we sell it like this, then we're going to be able to use it even more effectively in these other ways. So I very much appreciate bringing that perspective in and forcing us to make sure that we're as critical of the apparatus, mm-hmm. that we're using as we are optimistic and excited about the possibilities that it provides. Mm-hmm.
So self-determination, I think, is a term that at least in our workshop was brought up, and I think Mark, you use that phrase as a way in part of trying to capture some of the concerns that Ron and others were raising.
Right.
And I think we can think about it on two different levels, right? That as people who are perhaps using tools that are embedded in a current sort of corporate or financial structure, right? How do we, as selves, using these tools, right, how do we still punch back at, or how do we engage with them in ways that still allow for or encourage self-determination so we don't feel as though we're simply being somebody else's product, right? There's also the question, I think, of the self-determination of us as users of technology, not just people within particular frameworks, but pushing back against the idea that the causal effects go in only one direction, right? That these technologies have effects on us or on our society or on our attention span or whatever the causal arrow is claimed to be on the other end of that causal arrow. But okay, that may be true, but we're also shaping the technologies, right? We're pushing back as well. And so
absolutely.
And so that's another level in which self-determination, I think, was a theme in our workshop yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, we are being shaped by these things, but we are also in turn shaping them, or at least we have the capacity to do that, right? And so we aren't simply being marketed to or being controlled by, right? But we are in some ways also trying to market and do some controlling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think marketing, I don't want to sound necessarily anti-marketing. I'm not wedded to particular socioeconomic critique, mm-hmm. of the platforms. Mm-hmm. Some of my best friends are Marxists, yeah. but I'm not one.
Right.
So, and I think the marketing issue has surprised the engineers. I mean, they were interested in creating wide-ranging communication products.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surprising the users. But we can push back. Just because they create a mall doesn't mean that the kids are going to use that mall space the way that they intended. And see this in your work, And I see a lot of things that are going on, and that chaos, that flux is terribly important. Mm-hmm. You mentioned self-determination as one of the values, but also something that came up quite a bit was habits, good technological habits. You work on Aristotle, right? And the Hellenistic tradition, and there we have a lot of tools to think about good e-habits for our online lives. Tools that are actually, I think, that the present generation who grew up with this stuff know a lot about. Right. And as a teacher of social media ethics or social media philosophy, I'm interested in learning from them. Right. They're teaching their parents. My kids are telling me, your students, your adults, because they're going to listen to this.
Right.
I can't press the touch. They're teaching their parents how to be good purveyors and users of this stuff. So we need to figure out what these habits are and what these habits mean in our present age.
One of the things that I think, and this to link to you, Corey, because what Ron is saying is exactly right, that, you know, not only about habits, but about design, and that was something that came in a lot from your side, Vance, in the first session. But Corey, you're thinking a lot about trying to cultivate a more collaborative environment using YouTube and the blogs, and there are design questions and issues that are wrapped up with that. But the idea is, I think, is to see if you can get really a lot more substantive dialogue going in these media. You want to talk a little bit about that sort of struggle?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about some of the things that came up in our workshop. I mean, we can go back to the questions of the words public, what sort of public we're engaging in, what that means, and then what our role is in that particular public, and then what is the philosophy that we're doing as well. So the example with your work, Chris, is like public philosophy, collaborative research, scholarship, using new technology to make immediate conversations really beneficial and fruitful for the research that you're doing. That's the philosophical work. And then on my end, I think that it becomes more engaging the general public on philosophical issues that puts me more in the camp of philosophy as outreach, education, or I also like to think of it as activism and practice. But so at one point that came up of how to use the new technologies, Ron, I think this is what you were gesturing to, is using the technologies for unintended purposes. So I'm using YouTube in a way that's not to just show videos of people jumping off of roofs into pools, but instead to try to generate some sort of resources that'll be available to a wider audience that won't have easy access or be informed that there are people who are talking about these issues in ways that might be really interesting to them. So I've sort of co-opted the technology of YouTube and social media to try to make available a way of thinking. And what that has presented to me really poignantly, and it's been coming up throughout the workshops and the conversations, that it requires a certain skill set, that we have to not only develop new habits, but also cultivate certain skills that make that possible for us to be able to utilize the sort of media that is now available for us.
Yeah. One of the things that was interesting about, Kevin DeLaplante was in the second session, and he has actually kind of flipped the marketing thing on his head, in the sense that he's really taking advantage of the marketing side of the social media to create a critical thinking web space that is actually behind a paywall, and he's actually able to monetize that in a way that's allowed him to make some decisions about his own philosophical career that he might not have been able to make without that. And I think that that's an interesting way in which that marketing and the marketing side of things is actually being turned on its head, in the sense that it's serving him rather than, you know, big corporations, a big Google or Facebook, things like that.
This is something that I didn't bring up in your session yesterday, but that I've been sort of thinking about, and it's related to some questions that I've had in trying to figure out how to generate dialogue on the Rock blogs, is that, you know, one of the things that you're trying to do, it seems, is to pose questions in a way that force others to reflect critically and to provide provisional answers that then will be subjected to, you know, further critical scrutiny. So through the process of dialogue, we can come to understand our own positions better, understand other people's positions better, articulate them better, and make them more refined and more receptive to other considerations. And I guess one question that I have is, although it seems like social media can have this aspect to it, that it very easily can lead towards habits which don't involve that at all, and that I think we've both experienced, and frustration in terms of asking a leading question and then seeing that a lot of people are reading that question, but they aren't responding to the challenge that we're posing, right? So they may be consuming our media, right, without actually getting it in a certain real sense. That is, that we're not just providing you with something to look at, and having looked at, you can tell someone else, I saw this cool video, but having looked at, you are required to respond in a way that then gives me, you know, something else to do, right? So it's not just the video there and then a bunch of people having opinions about it. So that's one of the things that I'm sort of struggling with in trying to develop the Rock Blogs, but also thinking about in terms of some of the struggles that you were talking about, is that in some ways it seems perfectly situated to provide the kind of dialogue, but it seems like a real challenge to do that in this virtual space. Whereas, you know, face to face, it seems like, you know, when you put a question to someone, there's more of a sort of the weight is on them to then respond. Right. Whereas online, I don't have to respond. I can just reflect and go.
And to respond directly to what you just said, like, that is one of the key questions and difficulties that I've encountered in doing my work on YouTube, less so on the blog, because it's not intended so much, not so provocative. Like, it doesn't have hot topic issues that are being presented. But on YouTube, for instance, I have, like, been very clear that my intention is to make resources available. So I cite books, I cite philosophers, I read key passages from the chapters that are relevant to those issues to demonstrate how you can talk about these things. And unfortunately, I'm becoming quite cynical about the possibility for engaging dialogue on those venues, and that's one of my worries, that I can present the material, but I don't know where the dialogues go because I'm not having that dialogue with them. I'm not going to spend hours and hours responding to every comment, especially the ones that aren't that thoughtful. But it is interesting because then now my work has also moved into another venue of trying to talk about the value of philosophy and what it is in the first place. So on one of my videos on transphobic violence, anticipating that I was going to get a whole lot of really bigoted, ignorant responses from viewers, I put a link that was like, before you even watch this, go to the other video that talks about Foucault and philosophical aesthesis as a discipline of thinking and how we're going to go about doing that in the first place. So like I said, with skills that are required, I think there's a real dearth of how philosophical critical thinking is at all made available first to the general public. So while social media can make it available, we're assuming that they have the tools to be able to pick that up and utilize it in the way that we want them to. And that's a challenge. That's where I think other kinds of outreach or education and pedagogy and that kind of stuff come into play. And also why I'm trying to really be, like, careful with how I talk about my own work is that this isn't to replace scholarship. Yeah. And that came up in our session, right, too. This isn't to become what I do, or to say that this is sufficient. But I do think that it's valuable. And that's the feedback that I'm getting from the people who are following, you know, who are encouraging me to keep doing it because it means something. Even if it's not doing what I would hope on a full-range spectrum, it's planting seeds a little bit, you know? It's not sufficient, but I think it's necessary, not sufficient.
I think what's interesting about your work, Corey, is that that was sort of raised in the ethics session, is there's this continuing issue of scope and dissemination and consequences. Mm-hmm. And unlike some people, you have really thought through, you know, what you are doing and what the impact is, and you have good intent. Which is great, but not everyone is doing that. And one of the case studies that they brought up is this gay girl in Damascus, where although that was the person's description, they were none of those three words.
And they were in. But
what struck me was, you know, what a devastating impact this has, because it is huge. It's not, you know, someone said you're not just whispering to three people in the room. Whispers dissipate. They may travel. But there's a limit to how far they can go, whereas someone, 30,000 people can look at your YouTube video. Mm-hmm. You know, people can link to it, and that is what indeed happened in the case of this fraud slash hoax. And it really can have devastating ramifications. And in fact, the ramifications went well beyond what the author had ever dreamed of. And I think that the lesson there is you do have to be very, very careful and very wary.
Mm-hmm.
And there do need to be more people like you, Corey, who have really thought it through.
Okay. I think one of the things that, mm-hmm. that this brings up, and maybe Vance, you could talk a little bit about this, which is the question of design, which is something that's really interesting to me. So when the conversation doesn't go the way we want it to go in the classroom, we will reflect on, what happened? Mm-hmm. What did I do? How could I frame it differently? What could I do differently? How could I structure the course maybe differently so that there's more, I don't know, weight on participation or something, right? So we are always asking design questions. We're not thematizing them as design questions when we do it, when we're thinking about teaching usually. But one of the really powerful things that has come out of my work with teaching and learning with technology at Penn State, ET Education Technology Services at Penn State, and generally doing this is that I've been, I've had to and have found it very rewarding to engage with instructional designers at Penn State who have a very technical and a different kind of approach to, not different, but they're looking at education from a technical side. But I'm realizing that we need to think a lot more about the way design is, first of all, saturates everything we do.
Right.
And the way in which, a part of that reflection, Jessica, that you're talking about and that Corey, you're asking and you're doing on, you know, out loud on the podcast now and in this conference and at online, as you ask people, how can I make this more, how can we become more dialogical? Part of it has to do with design in a robust sense of design.
Well, I'm thinking about this in a pedagogical context, partly because last week at Guilford, the humanities division had a meeting where we were talking about, you know, the dreaded phrase learning outcomes and the other dreaded word assessment. And one of the points that was repeatedly brought up is it's not so much that we're not doing things that whose value we can't explain, it's that we're not doing a good job of telling the students why they have to do the things that they're doing, right? And you know, several colleagues say, well, in fact, I do that. You know, every day I tell them, okay, here's why this assignment is on the syllabus, right? Here are the skills and the habits and competencies that I'm hoping this assignment will help cultivate in you. So being very explicit at the meta level about what I expect and why I'm doing this way. The design decision, if you want to phrase it that way, in a classroom could be something like what I'm sure all of us have done before, where you take the loudmouths and when you have small group conversations, you make them, your job is to be the recorder, and you are not allowed to speak, right? Your job is to listen and keep a good record of what other people are saying, right? And so there's a design decision, where again, to foster a certain kind of conversation, you do, as the teacher, I think, have the responsibility and the privilege, right, to say, okay, how am I going to design this space in a way that makes more likely the kind of conversation that I want to have? I think with the YouTube videos, well, let me back up for a second. Ta-Nehisi Coates is one of my favorite bloggers. He writes for The Atlantic. And one of the things he does is, every so often he has a post where he says, I really like the community of commenters. I really like the way that you all are engaging each other. I like the way that you're being mostly respectful. And hey, those of you who are just joining me, here are some of the norms, right? Mm-hmm. So sort of constantly refreshing people's memories about why they're there and what the expectations are within that group of communicators. And also sort of informing / warning other folks, you know, if you can't play nicely in this space or if you're not willing to, you know, really be constructive, right, then you know, there's millions of blogs. Go somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you're not getting what you need here, mm-hmm. that's fine, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'll see you somewhere else, right? And so I think that's another way of...
Right, and that's one of the nice things about, theoretically, about doing what, Corey, what you're doing, and in some ways what I'm doing, and is that we have the luxury in a certain way of not having to think about eyeballs and numbers and monetizing in that sense, because we are, you know, I mean, the way I think I'm monetizing, you know, this and the books I write it are, you know, I have a good job at a university. They're paying me a salary. That's how this is all being monetized, right?
Right.
So there is maybe some advantages to being able to say, you know, this is the kind of discussion we're going to have, these are the expectations, and then, you know, encouraging others to, you know, move on if they, you know,
right.
if they're not engaging that way.
And just saying what your expectations are can be. Now, at a technical level, it's true, you could design, you know, perhaps on your YouTube channel, right, you could say only subscribers are allowed to post anything,
mm-hmm.
Or you know, you could design a comment system in a way where maybe so the slash dot site does this, right, where people have points that they can award to other people's comments, and so there's a kind of internal peer review among the commenting community, such that at least in theory, right, the people whose comments are more engaged and less trollish, you know, get more points, and you know that they are then.
Yeah,
taken more seriously, or what have you, right? So there are some design, you know, technical design ways also to try to foster more of a dialogue, and not just mm-hmm. not just say, well, look, you're here, you're commenting, you must be a nice guy, or you must be obviously you're here to contribute something constructive. Well, no, not necessarily, right? So how can I, you know, shift the playing field in a way as I design my comment system, right? That makes that kind of conversation more likely to happen.
I think. The issue of student evaluations, of assessment, of learning outcomes connects with your concerns that you, Van, shared with us, connects with Corey's concerns about this being scholarship. I think the ground is changing underneath this. And one example of that is new focus on learning outcomes, student assessment, and faculty assessment. Universities are changing in the United States. We see this in Louisiana, and Texas, and in Wisconsin. Mostly those states have involved public school retrenchment,
mm-hmm.
right? Forcing professors back into the classroom where they should be, you know, lowering the cost of education. There's this new line out there that, you know, that you should be able to get a degree for $10,000,
right?
So things are changing. And so I don't know what the future of the university is going to be. And I don't know what the future of scholarship is going to be, given also the burgeoning amount of information out there, the number of journals, the expense of the journals. There's just so much information. So, Corey, I don't know whether, I don't know the line between what you're doing and what scholarship is right now is going to hold. There's going to be the dusty Faustian, you know, bookworm in the cold and freezing in the stacks taking notes. That figure will never go away, right? And God bless them, right? We need to figure out just who, you know, Schopenhauer talked to on his 30th birthday. We need to know these things, right? someone does, not me. Someone needs to know these things. But we also, have room for the return or the resurgence of what aphorisms did in the 19th century, or philosophers in ancient Greece, you know, standing outside and screaming at the top of their lungs, or laying around in bathtubs, as a few of the cynics were wont to do, right? Diogenes, in particular, right?
Yeah. He was wont to do some other things.
He was wont to do some other things in public as well,
yeah.
Which would now be part of the YouTube world. Diogenes on YouTube,
actually,
right?
They would be
right?
Be
so
YouTube.
I don't know what the line is, and we're all just exploring that.
And I think that's an important point: is the dimension of play, the dimension of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know it's easier for those of us with tenure to explore and play than it is for a graduate student coming out and trying to figure out what is this new world that into which I'm entering. But the issue, I think, in a way is, you know, not only what will the university look like in 5, 10, 15 years, but what do we want to make it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, these are institutions that have, you know, 1,500 years of history, you know, behind them, and there's some things about them that are built to last,
right?
And that's a good. That some of those things are good. That is an institutional quality that can last. And I'm very interested now, increasingly so, in what are the institutional changes that need to be made? What are the things that we need to do to make or to encourage the institution to respond to what is really a revolution in literacy?
Yeah. It's also, what do we want philosophy to do?
Yes.
Right? We're all philosophers, and that means, that doesn't mean one thing. It means many different things. And so where do we want philosophy to go here? And where do we want, and how do we want to participate? And I think this is a fundamental question that each of us needs to ask. And it's not going to be answered alone by our disciplinary demands.
That's important. So maybe we could spend a few minutes thinking about out loud about that question.
Well, I actually I didn't attend the social media ethics session because instead I went to one on philosophy and other genres, which was put on by Richard Hart and Travis Holloway. And it was an interesting conversation, the way that the whole process kind of played out, because philosophy and other genres was talking about, first of all, literature and how philosophical insights can be embedded within creative writing, and then that creative writing can be used to spark conversations, whether that's with students or in other venues, so like at public libraries or on cruise ships was another example that came up a lot.
In a bath?
Can I sign up for that?
Right. Then the same thing was with poetry, but using poetry as a kind of a trigger, like a prompt, a poetic prompt, to get people to write, and then that Travis Holloway is the one who has used that work to, you know, talk to people in prisons, for instance, or at schools. And so it was interesting to have the conversation about what philosophy is, how it's done, how these other genres such as literature or poetry can be used. But then there was a tension that we kept coming up with throughout the whole conversation of saying, well, isn't there something specifically philosophical beyond just getting people to write about their feelings through poetry? And I was pushing, does it have to be that your philosophical training and background is what is embedded within your literature, so that only becomes meaningful for people if they can identify that, oh, that's philosophy that you're talking about in that story. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a question of the audience, too, of what are we presuming of the audience to be able to get out of creative writing if we're going to implant our philosophy within our literature. But beyond that, I was getting frustrated, too, about what venues and where are we taking this. And so Marcos was from Oregon State was one. He and I were together on, like, one side of the room saying, but what about beyond cruise ships? What about prisons? What about schools? What about talking to veterans?
Yes.
You know, what can philosophy do? What is specifically philosophical about the work that we can do as philosophers taking to other people who are non-philosophers, not just because they might enjoy hearing about Descartes through some story, but how can we use our skills to reach out? And that's the activism thread coming out again. And so that's my bent. I know that there are other people who share it, but it's not everybody's bent. And that's, I think, where Noelle's conversations were like, what is philosophy? What are we doing? And I'm glad, Ron, you brought it up, because that seems to be a recurring point that everybody is kind of, we have our own position on it, but
we're
need to have a shared understanding what is possible when we talk about these things.
And we're not so sure what it means to have philosophical import. Is it conceptual analysis?
Right.
Or is it reflecting on the meaning of being? These are two different traditions that refer to vast sets of literature.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, my favorite philosopher is a non-philosopher, Jaron Lanier, You're Not a Gadget, the author of You're Not a Gadget. Here's someone who has written a book, the kind of book that Kierkegaard wrote or that Rousseau wrote in the First Discourses, that's addressing what it means to be human in the 20th, at our fin di siglo, but at the beginning of the 21st century. Where have we been? Why aren't we doing this kind of work? Is it just because we don't understand the technology? That's I suspect that's part of the issue. But I also think that we're focused on many other things, and there's so much potential for us to do what we used to do, what Jaron Lanier and folks like yourself are doing now.
And to bring this back to Aristotle, right, and my conversation last week with other humanities colleagues, so in Aristotle, in the Nicomachean Ethics in particular, there's the tension between whether he's trying to say something about what humans characteristically are like, or whether he's trying to say something about how humans are uniquely, right? So, in other words, like, what do we do characteristically versus what do we do that no other species does? And so I think in our case, part of that tension as philosophers might be between, okay, what do we do that characterizes our discipline, right, versus, well, what do we bring that nobody else brings? And I think often, for me personally anyhow, the first question is easier to answer than the second one. There's more, perhaps, insecurity bound up in that second question, like, well, what do I bring that you couldn't get from, you know, someone trained in literary theory or someone, a playwright or a psychologist?
I mean, I think that's what's one was is come. I mean, there's the question of legitimacy is mm-hmm. always bound up with the question of identity and articulating one's identity, one's role, right? So, from my perspective, I get worried when it becomes a kind of thinking about, well, how do we legitimize who we are and what we, the life course we've chosen or the the literature we care about. I'm much more comfortable with, first of all, the idea that we have a body of literature that we can draw upon to bring to bear on issues of public importance. Okay, that's something that I think is a really powerful way of thinking about it. The other thing, though, is, you know, going back to the idea of philosophy not as a discipline but as a way of life, as a way of living reflectively in the world and asking questions about the nature of the human condition and our role in the world in which we live. And I think that's that does not resonate with a lot of professional philosophers, but it should, I think. There are a lot of skills associated with philosophy. There's no doubt about that. But I don't have a problem personally having a very blurry line between literature and philosophy, and between a lot of other disciplines, science and philosophy. Even. So, you know, those disciplinary arguments are often bound up with legitimation, with who gets what resources in institutions, with who gets on the program, as Ron, you were talking about, you know, yesterday. So,
yeah, I think the question about the concern with legitimation is an important one. And it's one that I find often the ways in which one practices what they're practicing seems great, and then I get turned off by the ways in which they then try and provide some kind of second order legitimation. Mm-hmm. That is, an example of what I take to be a larger phenomenon, that so many people think that in order to celebrate the virtues of one practice, I have to denigrate the values of another practice, right? And so I think I'm enough. I've read enough Hesse and been sort of interested in the ongoing struggle between the idea of the life of the mind as this kind of monastic draw yourself back from society and to overcome the obstacles that the public life and that society prevent. Or present for living a certain kind of life, but that view has always existed in tension with this other view of immersing oneself in the public life and in society in such a way that one is connected to what makes life valuable. And I think that I have tremendous respect for people who I would see as representatives of the thoroughly publicly engaged out there doing great things life, and then I also have tremendous respect for people who are more toward the side of the monastic life, and I don't think that either side needs to seek legitimacy through denigrating the other side, and that when it's done that way, to me at least, it makes me pose questions about their own sense of their own conviction that there is this sort of, there are these internal values that they can seek and that can exist, you know, alongside these other ones. And I wanted to mention that as when we are, and I think the same thing occurs when we are articulating what philosophy is versus, we don't have to articulate the values of philosophy by saying, and the literary theorist doesn't do this, and the scientist doesn't do this, and that we can talk about, you know, what philosophical conversation is like and demonstrate that practice. It would be nice to be able to articulate it in a way so we could have some definition, but that definition doesn't need to bring with it and anybody who's doing this other thing is just, you know, we're the ones who have it right. And, so there's that. And then I also wanted to say a little bit about
Amen.
What Amen, brother. Right. put in my two cents as one of the reasons that I do historical work in philosophy is because I genuinely believe that we have changing understandings and competing conceptions that are still live alternatives, right? Mm-hmm. That it's not that we have decided that that Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics were wrong, and so you know whatever comes after them has to be better than them. And where we are right now is the culmination of this of this progress. But rather, now, just as then, and just as in all the periods in between, there have been real substantive disputes amongst people that we now would refer to as philosophers about what philosophy is, about what the aims are, about what it is that legitimates this practice, about how it stands in relation to other practices. And so, you know, I think that we can find valuable resources in the idea of philosophy as a way of life, the idea of thinking about publicly engaged philosophy as a way of identifying some of the common obstacles to the achievement of the public good that we as philosophers and also as, not necessarily as philosophers, but also as public people and other people in other areas, can engage in identifying some of these common obstacles and reflectively trying to come up with ways to overcome them so that we're not just concerned with moving through pushing, right? Mm-hmm. But we're concerned with recognizing that there are directions in which we'd like to head. Sometimes there are obstacles to those directions, and one of the things that we need to do to be helpful is to remove those obstacles.
Definitely.
And that there can be resonances for that. It's not just that's an ancient idea of what the philosopher is up to, but that's as living today as it was back in the 5th century.
Well, I think that one of the tensions that I at least keep hitting very firmly is the institutional policies, the expectations and standards, and when and how or if the institutional standards will actually change, and where transformation can happen there. Because as a graduate student, you know, like, Chris, this is one of the contrasts between the two of us that we've been utilizing as a rich resource to think about, is like, what's the difference between you doing your work and me doing my work when you're tenured and I'm a graduate student, you know? And so what sort of hoops do I have to jump through? And not just me, I mean, other graduate students, these are conversations I have all of the time. This is why there's a certain amount of people who drop out, because they're so passionate about what they do, not because they think that it's useless, but because they want to do things that aren't allowed or aren't approved of, or end up being side projects or not taken seriously. So they have to go to other venues to do the work that they set out initially to do in philosophy. And so I have been stubborn and bullheaded to say, well, what about doing it within philosophy? And yet I'm constantly facing that tension of, when can transformation happen within an institutionalized academy? But I think that's the value of having these sort of conversations, and the point of the conference, and one of the main thematic forum questions on the Public Philosophy Network is, how can we work in collaborative mentor sort of relationships based on our different levels within certain academies and institutions, and then outside of those as well, to have productive, real conversations that might actually affect some change? Because it's one thing to say, yes, these are really unfortunate circumstances and who knows what is going to happen, but at the same time, like, will it? Right. Will it actually happen?
Well, but I mean, I think that's one of the powerful things. Well, first of all, transformation takes time.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look back on it, you see, oh, it seemed like it just happened, but mm-hmm. it takes time.
Right.
There needs to be people like you doing work that can be models for others, and so it needs to be done as you're doing it, with integrity and with thought and with a great deal of, but it's risky.
Mm-hmm.
It's hugely risky because we don't have models, really. I think, you know, from my perspective, my position as associate dean and as a tenured faculty member, I think there's things I have to do from, you know, that I hopefully can. But again, you know, moving an institution, even, you know, the smaller part of an institution, like moving the College of Liberal Arts as opposed to all of Penn State, you know, that takes time. But what's powerful is the ability to, we need to continue to perform it. We need to continue to show, okay, look, here are these YouTube videos, and here are the number of hits if you want some numbers, and here's what the concrete result of this. And here is the credential I presented at the Advancing Public Philosophy Conference, and that's going on the CV. That's a credential. That's a very real credential. So, you know, we need to keep doing this, but that doesn't take away the difficulty of it, and more for you than me, because your whole life is is that. I mean, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's a little too dramatic. But
no,
it,
right.
But it, but
it
it's,
all hinges on.
But I mean, you're finding your way. Yeah. It's already hard enough to find your way into, you know, professional philosophy as it's sort of the
right.
traditional path.
Right.
No,
well,
can I? Go ahead. Sorry. Oh, so actually, I want to disagree slightly with your,
uh-huh.
your idea that we don't have models for how this could happen.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It may depend, obviously, on how thoroughgoing a transformation you're seeking, but
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of three areas in philosophy. So I'm thinking of applied ethics, I'm thinking of feminist philosophy, and I'm thinking of philosophy of race,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, when Peter Singer first came on the scene, right, he didn't get a lot of
right.
respect from within the profession. I mean, applied ethics was not considered really something that respectable academic philosophers worried
mm-hmm.
themselves over,
for
right?
Sure.
And so there's a context where we can look and we can draw lessons. Okay, how was that eventually accepted to the extent that it has been, right? As, okay, yeah, this is something that legitimate philosophers do, that they do well, that others of us can learn from and listen to. The same thing with feminist philosophy, and certainly that and philosophy of race are ongoing places where, you know, whose legitimacy is contested. But in all three cases, I do think we have, you know, quote-unquote case studies where we
yeah.
can see, okay, what were the processes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what were the struggles that philosophers who had those interests and those passions,
mm-hmm.
You know, went through to achieve the kind of legitimacy? Did it involve establishing beachheads at certain places like Boulder, or, you know, specific programs that were friendly to
right.
those, to people
mm-hmm.
with those interests, or was there, you know, were there other ways in which the transformation was affected?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, for people thinking about how does digital technology change the way we think about philosophy, change the way we think about scholarship, change the way we think about assessing it, right? I think we have valuable
mm-hmm.
predecessors
yeah,
who can teach lessons.
Yeah.
And we all have to remember something that Anita Allen said in the plenary session, which struck me. You know, she said, look, this was the way of the world when I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then after this spate of pivotal Supreme Court decisions, by the time she was 17, the world was completely different.
Mm-hmm.
Still difficult, but different.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have to remember that the change does take time, but when it happens, it can happen very, very, it can ramp up very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It gets better, but
right.
but you do have to think for
right.
a change, right?
Yeah.
That is,
yeah.
that we, in order for
well,
the transformation to, in order for the transformation to happen, there have to be people who,
yeah.
who are, and again, I think I worry about the metaphor of pushing, and I like much more the metaphor of striving.
Right.
Instead of pushing to get this, to get
mm-hmm.
this through, we're striving to do something that hopefully others will, through our doing it, see
yeah.
that there is a kind of value that they didn't recognize before.
Yeah. These formerly marginal areas of philosophy that you mentioned, Vance, today some of that work is not only legitimized but highly valued
mm-hmm.
and has celebrity status
right.
within our academic world.
Right.
But there's a lot of life underneath the tip of the iceberg out down there that's brewing in the old
mm-hmm.
the ways that they've been brewing since, you know, the emergence of those areas. And
right.
both the tip and the heavy stuff at the base are interesting to me.
Right.
I think social media ethics, or I'm gonna coin a term, digital philosophy as a way of life, or,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know if I like that so much.
That it goes with e-virtue.
Right,
e-virtue.
Yeah, exactly.
E-virtue.
Yes, right. Can I get... Okay.
We have
copyrighted.
When you're in D.C., we can probably find the patent and trademark.
Right, right.
We have a lawyer right here. I don't know.
Right.
Not a patent lawyer.
So I want to
yeah.
register Virtue 2.0.
So that work's going to look a lot more like standard philosophy than not.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to find yourself living in a bifurcated world.
Right.
And that's necessarily so. But these are institutions. Institutions are resistant to change, and even... violently so.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of Epictetus, who is speaking to an interlocutor, and the interlocutor is complaining about working in the emperor's quarters. And he says, well, what do you expect? When you work with the emperor, you're going to get your back stabbed. I'm paraphrasing him. He's going to the top, right? And if you don't want to get your back stabbed, don't work there. And those are sort of hard words, especially coming from someone who is comfortably tenured and
right.
secure like I am. But I do think that insofar as you and others are reaching out into new modes of philosophy, manga, comics, poetry,
mm-hmm.
You know, social media, that there's going to be resistance. and you know, more power to you. That sounds trite when someone is so comfortable. I admittedly so, but there's going to be a cost.
But you also haven't been always so comfortable.
Right.
No, I haven't always been so comfortable. I've been very lucky, though, I have to say, right? I mean, I followed a bunch of a cadre of African-American philosophers who paved the way, people like Howard McGarry at Rutgers or Bernie Boxall at UNC, mm-hmm. and, of course, Cornel West, who I don't know where he's at right now. Right, he's online. He's on TV. He's in the streets. He's right now. He's on Wall Street, occupying it. Right, but you know, so there. I've been lucky in that regard that I rode a wave right when the work was being recognized. So see what happens. You know, let's be optimistic, but also let's be real about the institutional challenges out there, Corey. Also, none of us know what the future of tenure is going mm-hmm. to look like. You may be talking to the last few generations right now of people who have tenure in the United mm-hmm. States. Everything's up for grabs.
Yeah.
And it may be cold solace, but there could be some solace to be taken in the fact that it's not because you choose to work in these different ways that these things are questions. These things are questions for everyone
right.
who is, whether they're working in more traditional areas, there's the same kinds of concerns about how
yeah.
what I'm doing now is going to translate into
right.
All the hard work that has to go in so that when you do get lucky, you can take advantage of that
mm-hmm.
luck. You know, those are the same, you know, I know of what
right.
I speak in,
yeah.
in that way, and I'm sort of in between
right.
those who are comfortably tenured and,
yeah.
and those who are
right.
who are still, you know, grad students and recognizing that it's an issue that we all face.
Sure.
Right.
And if we stop asking, you know,
mm-hmm.
how we're going to improve, how we're going to change the way we do things, then we're tenured in the pejorative sense. That is,
that's
we're
right.
the ones who have
right.
have
mm-hmm.
stopped actually
right.
contributing
right.
to our fields and contributing to the, and so again, that's just
right.
to say that not to downplay the significance of these questions for you, but to say that you are certainly not alone.
Sure.
And
right, not alone.
Well, that's
feeling the existential import.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thank you all for the overwhelming support and encouragement during this hour. One thing that's coming to mind is, like, Vance, I really appreciate your point that there are models that have already
yeah.
been put in place. And, like, and I am fortunate enough, I mean, this is why I ended up at Penn State. I have people there who are supportive of the work that I have been doing, the real scholarship work. You know, feminist philosophy is my area of specialty. And I am working with some of those individuals when they were in graduate school in the 70s through the 80s were the forerunners in trying to push for the legitimacy of feminist philosophy. So I've heard their stories, what it was like to be a graduate student and how they had to, you know, work together, just a few of them, and have their own conversations and establish themselves and what they've been through. And that's such an excellent point to keep in mind. The other thing is that I'm not also, like, just pushing, we should be doing philosophy on YouTube, you know? Like, I don't want that to be over emphasized in all of this, but part of why I'm so emphatic about the position of graduate students coming up in the profession and questions about what is philosophy and how are we doing it is because I'm so sensitive to all the voices that I hear every other day from my peers, from other graduate students, and not
sure.
just in philosophy, mm-hmm. but in humanities in general, or in lots of different disciplines. But it is the sort of question that maybe is extremely poignant in philosophy because as philosophers we question, and I think we should critically question what we do, you know. But it's so these questions I know come up. They came up before I started doing videos on the internet of like, is this really worthwhile? Is
yeah.
this really practical?
Yeah.
Is this really going to make the difference that I want it to make in the
mm-hmm.
world? And that those are not new questions. And I think those always have to be perennial questions.
Seminar papers are not going to make as much difference as your YouTube videos.
And that is also true.
And also, the Rock
yeah.
Institute's a good example of the new world
right.
that we're in. I mean, you're doing work, reaching out across the discipline. It's interdisciplinary. This is what we need to do. I'm part of something called the McCarthy Center for Ethics and Values and the Public Good
mm-hmm.
at the University of San Francisco. I do work for them. No, I teach classes for them, and that's, I think, a future. I could imagine someone like you scaring the hell out of a lot of traditional philosophers because you're going to embrace something like online education in a way that we would resist. Mm-hmm. I could see you working inside of an academic field also, doing pioneering work at the Centers for Institutional Technology mm-hmm. At universities. So there's actually things happening on the ground that you could plug into
yeah.
And people like you could plug into that feed off the changes mm-hmm. that are going on in our institutional lives.
Mm-hmm. Right? And I think one of the points that came up in our session too was those YouTube videos that you have those are excellent advertisements for your own ability as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the things on the job market people are going to be looking for. Mm-hmm. You know, see some of those videos and they're going to say, okay, this person clearly can talk in ways that resonate with undergraduate students. And that's a huge credential. So, I mean, I think there are also ways, I take your point completely, Vance, that there are models. And I think it's important as we continue to do this work that, to draw on those models and to recognize, you know, the transformation is possible even in institutional levels, mm-hmm. but it does take some time. Sometimes it right. takes a generation to do it and then another generation or two to follow behind.
Right.
But it is possible.
I also think, one of the things I love about what you're doing, especially in the particular moment in which we're situated, is as institutions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Universities and colleges, I think, are... our legitimacy is being questioned. And not just humanities. I mean, especially humanities, which is
special
for Reno.
Yeah.
But, you know, even people in, you know, so-called real fields, you know, the question of tenure, the question of, the cost of an education, right? All of these things are, you know, raising real challenges and, you know, I think fair challenges to our current models. And so I think part of what's great about more public engagement, whether it be in the form of YouTube or whatever the digital forms it takes or analog forms it takes, again, is this is a way of engaging the public, publics outside of academia, I'll put it that way, right? That you know, we are constantly trying to make an argument to each other within our disciplines about the value of what we're doing and the ways we're thinking about questions, but I think we have also really to make that case and have that conversation with you know, folks whose tax subsidies provide support for universities or what have you, right? Mm-hmm. Folks who are thinking about spending $100,000 to send their children or themselves maybe to get an education at collegiate level, right? So I think it has multiple benefits, right? Not just in changing philosophers' understanding of what counts as traditional philosophy, right? But also in conveying something about the value of what we're doing, right, to people who, for good or for ill, are questioning that value,
mm-hmm.
right, outside the academy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to just take this opportunity to thank all of you for not only being on the Digital Dialogue, but for really a wonderful couple of days of conversation about these issues, social media and scholarship, the digital public, ethics. All of these issues are critical. I hope we can continue our discussions online in various forms. I know we have the Public Philosophy Network, which is in the process of continuing to grow and evolve, and hopefully will become a site where people really can engage in collaborative ways in this area. But it's always good to get face-to-face personal interactions, and that's one of the things I really have valued about the Advancing Public Philosophy Conference that we have and a chance for us all to be together. So thank you all for being on the Digital Dialogue. This has been the Digital Dialogue. The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. I invite you to visit us on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/digitaldialogue and on the blog at www.la.psu.edu/chrislong. This has been the Digital Dialogue.